From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Ebola outbreak. Displaced Muslims in the CAR in jeopardy. Search continuing for a missing Air Asia passenger plane. Plus, honoring pioneers in the life sciences. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. It has been a year since a small boy died of Ebola in a remote part of southeastern Guinea. Scientists say he was the first known case of this ongoing regional epidemic. Guinea has since reported at least 2,500 cases, but it's the country's neighbors, Sierra Leone and Liberia, that have been the hardest hit. Sierra Leone started a fresh push against the virus in mid-December. We get more now from VOA's Ann Look.
Sierra Leone is concentrating its efforts in the north and west of the country. The government prohibited public gatherings at Christmas. The northern district of Port Loko marked the holiday by declaring a lockdown as health workers went door to door. Health Ministry spokesman Sidi Y. Tunis says that's ongoing. The World Health Organization says transmission remains, quote, most intense in the west, including the capital Freetown. Cases began spiking there in November. There weren't enough Ebola treatment units, and the sick were staying home. Sierra Leone launched a massive surge operation in the west on December 17th. That included house-to-house searches and ramped-up education. The country was by that time armed with 5 new Ebola treatment units in the west, says Tunis. Its fleet of ambulances had tripled from 16 to 49, and there were 10 working labs, 5 in the west alone. But they needed to find the sick, and for that, Tunis said they needed to get communities involved. Enter the surge.
It is a community-led activity. We actually let the communities themselves come up with their social mobilizers, their contact tracers, and for them to also be part of the surveillance teams.
It will be weeks before Sierra Leone can judge the full impact of these new efforts. Ann Look, VOA News, Dakar.
Healthcare worker who returned from Sierra Leone has been diagnosed with Ebola and is being treated in a Glasgow, Scotland hospital. Nicola Sturgeon is the Scottish First Minister.
The patient returned to Glasgow late last night and, after feeling unwell, was admitted to hospital early this morning. The patient is currently stable and is in isolation at the Brownlee Hospital, pending transfer to the UK's high-level isolation hospital in London.
This is the first case diagnosed inside the United Kingdom. Cuban doctor Felice Baez, cured of Ebola after contracting the disease in Sierra Leone, said Monday he will be returning to West Africa. He was part of more than 250 Cuban doctors and nurses sent to fight the virus. Also, the latest figures from the World Health Organization indicating the number of people infected with Ebola is now surpassing 20,000. The death toll stands at 7,842. Hundreds of displaced Muslims trapped in a town in the Central African Republic are becoming more vulnerable by the day. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR is calling for this group of people to be relocated, and discussions with the CAR government are expected in the coming days. Nick Long has our report.
About 500 Muslims, mainly ethnic Pearls, have been in the town of Yaloke in western CAR since fleeing there 9 months ago to escape hostile Christian and animist anti-Balaka militia. In Yaloke, they have had some protection from French and United Nations peacekeepers and have been receiving some food aid. But they are trapped in a small area and unable to move outside it for fear of attacks. Health conditions have deteriorated. A mission led by the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Bangui recently visited Yaloke to provide medical help. The doctor with the mission, Elkana Dawacha, told VOA what he saw. He said the Pearl situation is deplorable and action must be taken urgently to save them. He described their living conditions as appalling. He said 40 people in the group died between April and December. Aid agencies say that figure includes 13 children. They say it's a far higher mortality rate than in the surrounding community, where only one death of a child was reported in the same period. The main causes of mortality among the children have been malaria and malnutrition, says Ndawacha. Many of the children, he says, display typical signs of protein deficiency, badly swollen feet, cheeks and eyelids, and emaciated bodies. He adds that the Archbishop spoke with the community's leaders who said the Pearl want to leave Yaloké and go to Cameroon, where they will be accepted and will be able to earn their living. The team evacuated one Pearl family with a very sick child to Bangui. En route, they were stopped at a checkpoint by anti-Balaka, who threatened to murder the entire family. Archbishop Diodone Nzapailanga and his team protected the Pearl family from attack, and the convoy managed to continue. The UN Refugee Agency also recently sent a mission to Yaloké, the second time UNHCR has visited the Pearl community there since August. On both visits, UNHCR found that more than 90% of the Pearls wanted to leave the country and were asking for an escort so they could do so safely. Human Rights Watch said in a report earlier this month that the government and the UN peacekeeping mission have a policy of not supporting evacuations of Muslims from the west of the CAR. A spokesperson for UNHCR told VOA it has been advocating for the relocation of the Pearl community from Yaloké for the past 4 months. Asked if UNHCR had made this call publicly, the spokesperson said, maybe not publicly, but within the humanitarian community. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
Recent studies are indicating that Burundi is the hungriest place on earth. War, poverty, and overpopulation have left up to two-thirds of the residents with chronic food shortages, stunting people's growth physically and also professionally, while rising demands for scarce resources pose serious problems for Burundi's stability. Hannah McNeish reporting from Ngozi in the north on the methods charities are using to fight the war on hunger.
Along many of the hillsides in Burundi's northern Ngozi province, rows of workers are digging and planting to try and stop fertile soils from sliding away in what is considered the hungriest place on earth. The United Nations World Food Programme's Cash for Assets scheme is currently paying more than 5,700 local farmers to work other people's lands after years of trying and failing to beat hunger by toiling their own. Farmers like 50-year-old Matthias Bukuru say that the $1.25 wage he's paid is a fortune compared to the self-enforced slavery he used to put himself through and still go hungry. He says the worst job he had was farming for someone and being paid 12 cents a day, which would only buy him a small basket of sweet potatoes that couldn't even feed his family. Studies by the International Food Policy Research Institute, a malnutrition watchdog, places Burundi last in 79 countries surveyed on food and poverty issues. A 12-year civil war that ended in 2005 left much fertile land fallow for too long or repossessed, while overpopulation has increased the pressure on food production. Bukuru and many others whose outsized clothes make them appear like teenagers say that they returned home after years in exile to infertile land and had no money to regenerate it. Jean-Dominique Masumbuko, agricultural coordinator for Christian charity World Vision, says that the signs of hunger and poverty are literally written on the faces of the people who sign up for the project.
He says
their hunger is visible and that you can see that these people have no strength, but in their faces there are signs that they haven't had enough to eat. He says another clue is that they appear bloodless, like they're almost dry. At a nearby clinic, wailing babies, sullen children and skinny mothers lined the benches. Some have children already enrolled in a WFP feeding program for chronically underweight children and breastfeeding mothers. One woman, Pascaline Minani, has a six-year-old son in the program but walked 5 kilometres here with her baby to see if she could get supplements to ensure this one won't be chronically hungry from birth as she breastfeeds. Sadly, Minani's measurements show that she's not quite thin enough in an area where food aid plugs the gap between the majority who are moderately hungry and the 10% who fall into a severe category and receive hospital treatment. Minani tells an all-too-familiar tale of not having enough land to cultivate and of disease that this year has wiped out her green beans and cassava, a tasteless but stomach-filling staple crop. Her only hope is for a small harvest of potatoes. Her only wish is to feed her children once a day, and if there's enough, herself, in a place where hunger occupies the minds of those with constantly empty bellies. She says she can't stop thinking about food and that when she's hungry, she tries to get something, but she often doesn't and doesn't feel right. But she just drinks water or stays hungry, as there's no other choice. She says she can't even find the words to explain what living like this is like. WFP says that recent studies show that feeding and agricultural programs have reduced malnutrition rates nationwide from 58 to 49%, and that Burundi's government is eager to eradicate hunger. But in a country where land officials say that disputes over a few meters of turf are turning deadlier and the population is booming, the war on hunger is far from won. Hannah McNeish for VOA in Ngozi, Burundi.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Search for a missing Air Asia jet has resumed off Indonesia, with officials believing the airliner may be at the bottom of the Java Sea. Plane disappeared from radar Sunday with 162 people aboard on a flight from Surabaya, Indonesia to Singapore. All of this comes just 9 months after the loss of a Malaysian jet that remains missing. We get more now from VOA's Jeff Seldon.
A day after Air Asia Flight 8501 disappeared during a storm, nervous passengers arrived in Singapore, having flown the same route from the Indonesian city of Surabaya.
It's eerie. It's like, and the flight just now was really bumpy. I don't know.
A pilot who has flown commercial airlines in the region tells VOA weather, including sudden storms, has always been an issue for planes in Southeast Asia, and that pilots and controllers often have to rely solely on radio communications instead of newer and quicker technologies. Before it disappeared from radar, the crew of the missing Air Asia plane asked to fly at a higher elevation to avoid some clouds. Keith McGuire is with the University of Southern California's Program for Aviation Safety and Security.
Some weather patterns, strong convective activity, is very dangerous to aircraft of any size. And so that's why you see commercial pilots deviating around really strong cells of weather.
But McGuire, a former regional director with the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board, says it's still way too early to blame weather for the loss of the plane.
As new facts come in, there's a tendency, it's just human nature, there's a tendency to look at it and say, oh, maybe this is it. But this early in the game, no, a professional investigator isn't going to be jumping to any conclusions at all.
For now, authorities are promising to look at every possibility.
Saya juga telah memerintahkan kepada Menteri Perhubungan.
Indonesia's president telling a news conference he's ordered a review of all aviation procedures and processes. Meanwhile, Air Asia Chief Executive Tony Fernandez and other company executives are doing their best to calm a jittery public.
There's a deep sense of depression here, but we'll stay strong.
He says AirAsia's carried 220 million people to this point, and that, quote, we are confident in our ability to fly. Indonesia's leading the search for the plane, which went down over the Java Sea about halfway through its flight. Malaysia, Singapore, and Australia are taking part in the effort, and on Monday, Jakarta asked the United States for help. The State Department says it's determining how the U.S. can best aid the search. Jeff Seldon, VOA News, Washington.
Numerous people were killed on a ferry that caught fire in the Adriatic Sea on Sunday. Sayla Hennessy reports.
Italian Premier Matteo Renzi said Monday the ferry blaze killed some passengers.
Nel giro di qualche ora contiamo di terminare le operazioni.
He says four corpses were recovered at sea during rescue operations Monday. A Greek man died on Sunday after being trapped in a lifeboat chute. Renzi expressed his gratitude to the rescue crews.
Io stanotte ho passato la notte comodamente a letto rispondendo ai.
He says his prayers go to the families of the victims who have gone through this very painful experience. A fire broke out on the car deck of the Norman Atlantic in the early hours of Sunday morning. The ferry was in the Adriatic Sea, traveling from Greece to Italy. Helicopters rescued nearly 500 people from the top deck of the ship, despite rain, strong winds, and choppy waters. One survivor, a Greek truck driver, described how the rescue scene had been chaos and panic. He said passengers had been frantic to escape the flames and pelting rain and trampled each other to get onto helicopters. Rescued passengers were taken to the Italian port city Bari early Monday, where they were receiving health evaluations. Admiral Giovanni De Tullio of the Italian Coast Guard said every passenger would be examined. He says the passengers appear to be in good health, but will be assessed to determine if they need hospital treatment. Most of those on board were Greeks, but others hail from Italy, Germany, Britain and elsewhere. Selah Hennessy for VOA News, London.
French press agency reporting that oil prices rose Monday as fresh violence in crude producer Libya stoked concerns about possible supply disruptions. Forces loyal to Libya's internationally recognized government has carried out airstrikes against Islamist militias following attacks on the country's crucial Al-Sidra oil export terminal. The Fajr Libya group has been trying to make Al-Sidra the nearby Ras Lanuf terminal since last Thursday when it killed at least 22 soldiers in a surprise attack. Seven oil storage tanks at Al-Sidra were set on fire as a result of the fighting. United States on Monday imposed sanctions on four more Russian officials, including two in Chechnya, for alleged human rights violations. There are now 34 names on the sanctions list. Criteria for inclusion include people involved in the abuse of others and responsible for extrajudicial killings, torture, or what the U.S. State Department calls other gross violations of human rights. State Department officials says the sanctions list could have the effect of putting Russian officials on notice that may be held personally responsible and liable if they are involved in gross violations of human rights. Here in the U.S., President Obama spoke on National Public Radio Monday, where he was asked to assess his presidency up to this point as he looks toward his final 2 years in office.
I could look back and say we are as well positioned today as we have been in quite some time economically, that American leadership is more needed around the world than ever before, and that is liberating in the sense that a lot of the work that we've done is now beginning to bear fruit, and it gives me an opportunity then to start focusing on some of the other hard challenges that I didn't always have the time or the capacity to get to earlier in my presidency.
Mr. Obama, a Democrat, also said Republicans in Congress are in a position now to so they can govern responsibly. In the November national election, Republicans won both control of both houses of the U.S. Congress.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
The Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on New York's Long Island may be relatively unknown to the public, but it is a highly revered institution among biologists, geneticists, and other life science researchers. VOA's Adam Phillips attended the lab's Double Helix Award ceremony in New York for our report.
It was evening dress only at an ultra-posh Manhattan venue where many of America's scientific and philanthropic elite gathered to honor three whom the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory deemed worthy of the 2014 Double Helix Medals. They're awarded each year to recognize those who've made outstanding contributions to the human understanding of genetics and the life sciences.
Tonight is not only a celebration of science and the people who support science, but I think an expression of the types of research that we do that is having an enormous impact in lots of different fields.
Bruce Stillman succeeded DNA co-discoverer James Watson as the lab's president in 2003.
For instance, just think about the world population. It's growing at a fairly significant rate. And how are we going to feed all of those people? And how are we going to create the energy that's needed to sustain our population over the next 100 or 200 years? We believe biology is going to be a major, major input in that, and genetics can have a major impact in those areas. One of our scientists has recently developed crops that actually double the yield of fruit just purely by understanding the timing of flowering. And that's an amazing discovery. It's going to revolutionize agriculture.
But it's the genetics within humans, not just the genetic relationship between humans and other life forms, that make up most of the research work done at the lab, says spokeswoman Dagnia Zeidlikas.
The research that we do in biology can be categorized into a few separate categories. Genetics and genomics research, where we are studying genes and the human genome, the strand of DNA that makes you, you, and me, me, and then taking that information and translating it into understanding diseases like cancer, which is a genetic disease, understanding diseases like autism, like schizophrenia, which are genetic diseases, understanding other types of genetic functions in our body that would impact things like diabetes or obesity.
Matthew Messelson of Harvard University was awarded a Double Helix Medal for his discoveries on DNA replication and the evolution of sexual reproduction, among other things. He recalled how his love for biology and genetics was first aroused.
As a very young child, I wanted to understand what makes things alive. How could you take ordinary dust or inorganic matter and put those atoms together and get something that was living? And that we know now. That is one of the great accomplishments of modern biology. We know about DNA. We know how it replicates itself. We know how it controls the functions of cells and how cells develop to form whole organisms, their body pattern, and all that.
Marlo Thomas also garnered a medal. Already famous as a film and television star, best-selling author, and co-founder of Ms. Magazine, Thomas is widely acclaimed in her role as the National Outreach Director for the St. Jude Children Research Hospital, a Midwestern facility that combines world-class medical research with free, compassionate care to kids with cancer and other genetic diseases.
Hope is our message. Children come from all over the country, all over the world, with death sentences from other hospitals. It's not that these other hospitals aren't good. They're good hospitals, but they're only working with what they know. We're working with what they don't know. We're working with what we don't know because we're a research center and a treatment center under one roof. So we're really finding we're studying disease, and then we make kids better too.
Families also have a place in the work of Double Helix honoree and National Book Award recipient Andrew Solomon. His bestseller, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, examines ways that Down syndrome, schizophrenia, autism, and other genetic conditions play out within families. Indeed, public education about biology and genetics is a key element of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory's mission. Its on-site programs host thousands of school children every year, and it maintains several satellite centers around the world. Now more than ever, says spokeswoman Dagnia Zeidlikas, cutting-edge research goes hand-in-hand with an informed and engaged public. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And Alexander Gerst, a European Space Agency astronaut, has created a spectacular 6-minute time-lapse video utilizing more than 12,000 photos taken from the International Space Station. You can view them at esa.int/space-in-videos. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On December 30th, 1922, the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republics was created within the territory of the former Russian Empire and included the Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian, and Transcaucasian Soviet republics. Characterized by one-party rule and a centralized economy for nearly 70 years, the Soviet Union expanded to include 15 republics and become the largest nation in the world, encompassing nearly one-sixth of the world's landmass. In 1947, King Michael of Romania was forced by the communists to abdicate his throne. The Romanian People's Republic was proclaimed. On this day in 1965, Ferdinand Marcos was inaugurated president of the Philippines. Marcos's regime would span 20 years and be marked by misuse of foreign aid, repression, and political murders. In 1993, Israel and the Vatican signed an agreement of mutual recognition. In 2004, on this day, a fire in a Buenos Aires, Argentina nightclub killed 194 people. In 2012, Line 6 of the Beijing subway system opened, making the metro network one of the longest such public transportation systems in the world. On this day in 1969, the folk singing trio Peter, Paul, and Mary received a gold record for their last and biggest hit single, Leaving on a Jet Plane.
All my bags are packed. I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking.
Leaving on a Jet Plane was written by a very young John Denver, who was then a member of the Chad Mitchell Trio. Denver went on to an illustrious solo career in the 1970s. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the most effective ways to make life difficult for those who deliberately cause harm to others is to take away their ability to use their bank accounts or to raise new funds, and to prevent them from spending those funds still within their possession to purchase what they need to carry out their nefarious agendas. So you lock them out of the international banking system, thus taking away their ability to transfer money to vendors and to receive money from donors. You freeze what funds they may have in the banking system, and you ensure that no businesses or manufacturers will trade with them. That is essentially what happens when the United States designates, under Executive Order 13224, an individual or group deemed to be terrorist in nature or likely to commit terrorist activity, thus posing an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, foreign policy, and economy of the United States. On December 18th, the U.S. Department of State designated the Ajnad Misr Group, as well as Ibrahim Arubesh, as specially designated global terrorists. Ajnad Misr is the only terrorist group that operates exclusively in the greater Cairo area. It grew out of another designated terrorist organization, Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, announcing its existence in January 2014. Since then, Ajnad Misr has been the most active terrorist group operating in Egypt outside the Sinai Peninsula. The group targets state actors. To date, it has claimed at least 15 attacks on public officials and their vehicles, government buildings, and public spaces. Ibrahim Arubesh, also known as Ibrahim Suleiman Mohammed Arbesh, is a senior leader of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or ACAP, itself a foreign terrorist organization and specially designated global entity. He serves as a senior advisor for the group and is involved in the planning of attacks. He has served as a senior ACAP Sharia official since 2013 As such, he provides the justification for attacks conducted by ACAP. By designating Ajnad Misr and Ibrahim al-Rubish, the United States is taking a decisive step toward starving the group and individuals of their resources, disrupting their ability to execute their deadly agendas, and ensuring that they find it ever more difficult to carry out their acts of violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.